Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is September 22, 2003. Today's session is entitled Pandering by Faith Leaders, presented by former Illinois State Senator Paul Simon. Number LENS 2003-02. Let's listen in.
For our second presentation, Senator Paul Simon.
I thank you. I thank you all. I am, incidentally, they said this my previous lecture, some people couldn't hear, and they switched the mic a little over. Can you hear me back there okay? You'd sooner not? Oh, okay. Everyone else hearing okay? Good. My assigned topic tonight is Pandering by Faith Leaders. I have a book coming out in a few weeks titled Our Culture of Pandering. I talk about people in politics following the polls. I mentioned that a little bit earlier. Talk about people in the media where the O.J. Simpson trial gets far more attention than the fall of the Berlin Wall because you get readers and viewers. Field of education, just about anyone who examines the field very much knows that in our elementary and secondary schools, we ought to be attending more. Singapore, you go to school 280 days a year. Japan, 243. Germany, 240. Average in the United States, a little less than 180. Can we learn as much in 180 days here as you do in Japan at 243? Obviously, you can't. Why do we go 180 days? Well, in theory, so our children can go out and harvest the crops. Yeah. It was a totally different era. And but political leaders, school board members, others are reluctant to start talking about something that might not be popular. And the fourth area I hit, I hate to say, is the field of religion. There is this story, I've read it a couple of times. I don't know whether it was made up or it is real, but supposedly a visitor from Europe was visiting an Episcopal church in the United States. Could have been a Lutheran church. But he said, I notice your pews have cushions. And then he added, and I notice your sermons also do. Religion can be a powerful force for harm or a powerful force for good. And as you look at the Middle East, for example, the roots, I hate to say, are religious. I always remember when Bill Clinton made his first visit to Northern Ireland, spoke at a factory north of Belfast, and the last paragraph in the story said the factory had separate entrances for Catholics and Protestants. You think, how can faith be distorted like that? I was asked to head an international team monitoring the presidential election in Croatia, I guess about 4 years ago. And they took me around to different sections of the country. And in small community after small community, I would go in and they would say, well, the first buildings hit in these in this mini civil war were the Roman Catholic Church, the Orthodox Catholic Church, and the mosque. What has happened? And our inattention, and this goes to the media, but I think it reflects on how we speak up to the media. I happen to think the best newspaper in the United States today is the New York Times. New York Times has 57 reporters covering sports, 2 covering religion. I don't know what the message there is, but it's not good. It's not good. We need courage in each of the 4 categories that I mentioned. There was a man sitting on his front porch and a lawn that needed to be mowed, and a lawnmower out there ready to go. And he was sitting there praying that the lawn would be mowed. Something's wrong with that prayer. Prayer involves, if it's genuine, involves a commitment. This noon, we prayed, lead us from hate to love, from war to peace. Let peace fill our hearts. Let peace fill our world. And then tonight, we prayed, to those who have bread, give hunger for justice, and to those who hunger, give bread. We too easily are like that man on that front porch. We repeat words, but we don't follow through with a commitment. I got a phone call, this is when I was in the state legislature, from president of a men's club at a church in Alton, Illinois. And he said, we heard you speak, and we'd like to take on a social project. Well, the day before, a man who had just served some time in prison came to me from Wood River, Illinois, and he was desperate for a job. So I told the president of the men's club, I have just the project for you. And I told him about this man who was desperate for a job. And about 2 weeks later, he called back, and he said, do you have an easier project for us? Faith was never meant to be easy. And when you and I do the extra little things that can influence what happens, and we don't know when we're going to influence. It's like when you preach a sermon. Who are you reaching? You don't know. When you teach, you don't know. But let me give you just one illustration. And I was talking, I don't know where Darren is or if he's here. I had dinner with right back over here. I told him about a little bit about an abolitionist. There was an abolitionist by the name of Elijah Lovejoy. He didn't start out as an abolitionist. Went to what is now Colby College in Maine, then walked to St. Louis, believe it or not, and started teaching there, and then bought a half interest in the St. Louis Times, a newspaper there, and went to a Presbyterian revival service, and a pastor by the name of Potts, P-O-T-T-S, preached the sermon, and among other things, said slavery was an evil. And Elijah Lovejoy describes himself as being converted at that point, went back to Princeton Seminary, and after graduating from Princeton Seminary, some leaders in St. Louis, a town of about 5,000 then, said we'd like a newspaper that gave us some moral uplift. And he accepted, and he came back. And I won't go into the long story, but his equipment, he started fighting slavery. His equipment was destroyed. Eventually, he was killed by a mob in Alton, Illinois in 1837. And it shook the nation. John Quincy Adams called it a cultural earthquake. They had protest meetings all over the nation. At a congregational church in Ohio, a young man stood up at the end of the protest meeting and said, I'm going to devote my life to fighting slavery. His name was John Brown. And with Lovejoy was the president of Illinois College in Jacksonville, Illinois, by the name of Edward Beecher. And Beecher was moved, but so was his sister. His sister was Harriet Beecher Stowe, who wrote Uncle Tom's Cabin. Maybe none of the, and so it had a huge impact on the anti-slavery movement. The biggest impact of anything until a publication of Uncle Tom's Cabin. But maybe none of it would have happened but for that Presbyterian minister who had the courage to stand up in a slave state and say slavery is a sin. Courage to stand up. We somehow have to be doing better. And one of the advantages of a church, and this would apply to a synagogue or a mosque too, one of the advantages is we can do things collectively. There is a marvelous book that I would recommend anyone reading called Bowling Alone by Robert Putnam, in which he basically says we're not going to really change things in our society in a significant way unless the religious community gets involved. And I think that is correct. If we just live in isolation, not a member of a congregation, we're unlikely to do something. But a congregation, any one of you could have your congregation have a brainstorming session by some of the members. Say, how do we more effectively reach out to the poor, both here at home and abroad? And then collectively, people will do things that they just wouldn't do. Instead, they'd be home watching Monday Night Football or whatever it is. We have an opportunity, but it does require faith leaders to stand up. I read an article, and I wish I had saved the article, and I can't remember who wrote it or where it appeared, but it was an article about inner-city churches, and it said inner-city churches that strive to survive rarely survive. Inner-city churches that strive to serve survive. And I think that is probably accurate. And I think if I may use, and some of you may have heard me use this before, because it was a powerful lesson to me. I used to be, I didn't like wakes, because I never felt real comfortable talking to people, and I didn't feel comfortable. Usually, wakes are There's some group of people who are laughing and having a good time, and I didn't feel comfortable joining them. And then my father, who was a Lutheran minister, died, and we had the wake. And then people started coming through that line. Some of them, you could tell, they just weren't used to being dressed up and with gnarled hands. And they would tell me how my father helped them when they had this problem or that problem or whatever it was. My dad used to volunteer every Thursday morning at a school for the mentally retarded. But at the end of the evening, I realized that my father, who I think was a pretty good preacher, if I may be immodest in saying that, but I realized the great sermons he preached were not from the pulpit, but by what he did. And I think that is true of almost all of us. I think, you know, by their fruits ye shall know them. And I think we will communicate, and will communicate, and maybe I'm more sensitive to young people now that I'm on a college campus, but a lot of them are indifferent to organized religion as we know it. Doesn't mean they're not religious. In a sense, they have religious inclinations. Bill Bennett, who was Secretary of Education, but he wrote one time, Boston University, where he taught, is one-third Catholic, one-third Protestant, one-third Jewish, two-thirds of them believing nothing. And there may be some truth to that, I'm not sure. But what I am sure of is there is an inclination on the part of young people to not adhere to any profession of faith where it says we have a monopoly on truth. And second, they want a faith that is relevant, that really lives. And too often, our faith does not live. Too many churches, in fact, have a sign on the front of them. We can't read it, but we know it's there. It says, "Do not disturb." And we need to somehow disturb ourselves and the people who belong to our churches. I was a young green state legislator when Martin Luther King asked me to come down and speak at the second anniversary of the bus boycott down in Montgomery. I was 28 years old. He was 28 years old. We were both green. And I spent 2 days with him and Ralph Abernathy and Rosa Parks and the others. In Greater Montgomery, there were two white ministers who were willing to stand up for Martin Luther King. One was Bob Gretz, some of you may know, who was ALC, going back to previous incarnation of your synod. And the other, and I don't remember the man's name, but it was a Methodist minister with red hair. That's all I can remember. Somehow we have to be showing courage. And it's not being shown as much as it should be. In the process of writing another book that will be coming out in May, I learned about someone from the state of Washington, Ann Medlock, I think is her name, who started a group called the Giraffe Society. People who are willing to stick out their necks for a good cause. And it's interesting, they have chapters in all 50 states. I have never met her. I've talked to her on the phone. There's so many causes that need the church to stand up. And if it is correct, I've never counted the passages on poverty in the Bible, but they say there are over 2,500 passages commanding us to look at the poor. What does the Lord require of thee? Not, it'd be nice if you did these things. The lack of response to poverty, both at home and abroad, I've thought about why did we respond on segregation in the South, which was terrible. I always remember Hubert Humphrey's last speech before the passage of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. He read a list of motels and hotels in the South that would admit African Americans. Then he read a list of motels and hotels in the South that would admit pets. And the second list was a lot longer than the first list. Segregation offended us, but hungry people should offend us too. And maybe the reason religious leaders stood up was there was opposition. There were a lot of people in the pews who didn't agree that the church had any business standing up. While on the question of poverty, it's kind of, you know, motherhood and apple pie, everybody agrees, but there's no opposition, and so there's no enthusiasm. I'm not sure what the reason is. I pulled together a symposium at our Public Policy Institute on poverty and the religious community, and we had Imam Wallace Muhammad, the Muslim leader. We had the Rabbi Rubenstein, the head of the Orthodox rabbinical group. We had the head of the Unitarian Church, Bishop Riley, I think is his name, from New Jersey, and from the ELCA, and Pat Robertson was one of those who was there. And it was interesting, people who hadn't worked together and then all of us, you know, gradually come together. And whenever there was a break and when there was a disagreement, I would say, will you two get together and see if you can work out language? And I remember Pat Robertson sitting down with John Burens, the head of the Unitarian Church, and I'm sure they never sat down together before. And they passed nice resolutions, and there has been, you know, a couple of Roman Catholic dioceses have done some good things, but the dialogue in itself was good, and it was genuine. I remember the head of the Disciples of Christ saying, we've issued joint statements. We've never really wrestled together with an issue. And I remember, and I don't think he would mind my mentioning this, Pat Robertson saying, we ought to say something about family values and illegitimacy. And one of the African-American leaders said, I'm all for saying something about family values, but I think you ought to know I'm illegitimate. And there was that moment of stunned silence. You know, we all learn from these things. The Methodist bishops issued a statement, say, it says, look for disciples, not numbers. I kind of like that. And you will forgive me, where did Norman disappear to, or my fellow Missouri Synod Lutherans, right back there. Okay. You're going to play the accordion afterwards? I got a letter from St. Matthew's Church in Chicago, where they have a food program, and it mentions that they're the only Missouri Synod church in the Northern Illinois District that has a food program. I called to find out how many churches there are in the Northern Illinois District, 245. They have one woman who works part-time to help in the food program there. I'm sure I could find similar statistics for the ELCA and other groups. I meant to bring this along, and I unfortunately don't have it. But I read about an Episcopal church in New York City where they were down to about 25 or 35 members, and the bishop indicated he was considering closing the program. And some people came to the door of the Episcopal pastor there begging for food, and he got some members of his congregation to sign notes for $50,000, and they started a food program. They now have the largest food program in New York City, and they serve almost 1,000 people a day, and the church has grown. The church has built a new, believe it or not, $5 million facility. And they built a new facility after the other church burned down. And when the other church burned down, because of all the good things they were doing, it made the New York Times and all the New York media. And then that next day, they served 900 and some people by candlelight. And it made the news again. Positive news. We can do this. I would like to see, if I may suggest, a very practical idea. I've looked at quite a few annual reports lately of churches, and they have things that should be in there: baptisms, confirmations, funerals, weddings, and they will have what's in the bank account and whether the roof needs to be repaired. I'd like to have an annual report that includes Matthew 25, the judgment day scene. I was hungry. What is our church doing for the hungry? You know what Lutherans as a whole, this is all synods combined, doing with Lutheran World Relief? We're contributing just over half a cent a day. Can we do better? Of course, we can do better. I was thirsty. What are we doing? World water problems. I'm going to talk about that a little tomorrow. I was a stranger. What are we doing for homeless people? I was naked. I was sick. I was in prison. Number of churches that do anything for people in prison or people who've been discharged, my impression is very, very few. And things can happen. I belong to a small congregation in Carbondale, Illinois. Our pastor, name is Bob Gray. And you may remember about 3 or 4 years ago, there were floods in Honduras. And we had some students from Honduras in our community. And Pastor Gray started heading the effort. And our church, and I have to say, we had got cooperation from some of the businesses and the Methodist Church and some others. But we raised $130,000 in money and drugs and blankets and other things. And about 4 weeks later, I got the Lutheran Witness, and it said, for Missouri Synod portion of Lutheran World Relief. We gave $135,000 for Honduran flood relief. 2.7 million people, $135,000. Our little congregation of 150 raised $130,000. The potential is there, but we're not doing what we should. We can't ignore public policy. A country called Germany, half Lutheran, half Catholic, people didn't want to get mixed up in politics, and so they were quiet while Hitler came to power. We were living in Eugene, Oregon in February of 1942 when President Roosevelt said to 115,000 Japanese Americans, "You have 1 to 3 days to sell everything you own, put it all into one suitcase, and we're going to take you off to camps." Not a one of them had committed a crime. And I remember my father speaking on a local radio station saying this was wrong. And I was 13, and my friends in school were giving me a rough time. I was embarrassed by what my father did, and we got the hate phone calls. But now it's one of the things I'm proudest of my father for. And I look back, and I think, where were all the other people who should have stood up for the rights of their fellow Americans? Or right now, at Guantanamo, we have over 600 people there being held now for almost 2 years, three of them boys, 13 to 16. We do not provide information. We say we're in a war on terror. And then they say, well, if you're in a war on terror, then live up to the Geneva Accords and, you know, give them counsel and provide information. And we say, oh, but we're not at war. You know, we can't have it both ways. Someone, and the U.S. federal courts so far have said anything that happens beyond the jurisdiction of the United States, we can't do anything about that, falls outside of our jurisdiction. Now, the Supreme Court may reverse that. I don't know. But there ought to be people speaking out. I was just looking at statistics from Zambia in Africa the other day. And the indications are the average lifespan is either the two figures used in the same report. One said the average lifespan is 42 years. The other one says 37 years. Our average lifespan is 77 years. We're killing people with the quiet bullets of indifference. And the church ought to be part of changing that. Way back when, was part of a committee to build a new church, and I think, and I'm not sure this is accurate, I think we raised $196,000 to build the new church. What if I had gone to the next congregational meeting and said, let's raise $196,000 to feed starving people? Now, it's a reflection on my faith that I didn't go there and do it. But I think I know what would have happened if I had. We simply have to do better. Here's another article, today's paper. U.S. copter attack on tent kills Taliban commander. 10 tribesmen also die, Afghan official says. the Afghan official said 10 innocent nomads were killed because of the Taliban. I have an idea that's not how it's read by the families of those 10 people. We ought to be speaking up. Jim Fallows, who was editor of U.S. News and World Report, not talking about the world of religion, but I think it applies to us. He says, the more successful people are, in theory, the more they can help the disadvantaged. But the reality is that the more successful people are, the more they get enchanted and excited by their own self-serving activities. I think that is correct. How do we build bridges? Well, I think we have to do that. And bridges not just to the poor, but people of other faith groups too. I mentioned an annual report. I'd love to see, and we have two bishops here, I'd love to see you encouraging that. A brainstorming session. I've seen this work not on in a church, but in other settings. Get 10 of the creative people in your congregation together at someone's home, not a restaurant, and just exchange ideas, what you might do to live your faith more effectively. And also, how do we reach out to others? And then I guess I would like to also see some sermons that ask questions. You don't need to provide answers all the time, but to prod the conscience of those of us in the pews. We can do better, but we have to recognize that what we're doing now is inadequate. Back some years ago, I had the privilege of serving with a senator from New York, a great senator, the name of Jacob Javits, who was defeated. And shortly after he was defeated, it was discovered he had Lou Gehrig's disease. And Jack Javits, who used to swim every morning at 8 o'clock in the morning, and very vigorous, you could just see him declining. And about 8 weeks before he died, he was wheeled into my office, and he was wearing a device in his chest to keep him breathing, and they plugged it into the wall. And he started lobbying me on a bill he was interested in. And when he finished, I turned to him and I said, Jack, you're an inspiration. And I'll never forget his response. He said, Paul, you have to have a mission in life. I think that's correct. And the church has to have a mission beyond the message, do not disturb. And you're the people who can help to change things. Thank you. I thank you. I'm going to take you around wherever I speak. How about three questions, okay?
When we do this, we'd like you to speak at the mic the question so that we can record it.
More of a comment that I would like to make you have a comment to. Robert Lifton once said that the number one neurosis in our society today is psychological numbing, that for us, in order to survive, we need to feel, we don't want to feel so much. And that was back in the 70s. The second part was Martin Marty in the 80s. I happened to hear him in a Nebraska church convention. And he says, 15,000 people are starving to death each day, and we don't give a shit. And then he proceeded to say, why is it that you're more upset with the fact that I use that word than the fact that 15,000 people are starving to death? And then in the Martin Marty style, he was able to make a brilliant, you know, comeback that really woke us up from, I think, our own psychological numbing. So comments about that?
Well, I think your comment I agree with your comment. You know, we need to be awakened. And the way he handled that awakened that audience.
Yes, I'm Pastor Sarah France from Everett, Washington, Scoop Jackson's stomping grounds. And I just wanted to ask you, after your experience in Israel, we're going to be doing a sabbatical there, my husband and I, in the summer of 2005. What do you think we in the churches need to be doing or studying or being in relationship to Israel right now?
Yes, I would, and I'm going to talk a little bit, not so much about the Israeli Middle East situation as a couple of others, but I think we have to demand of our leaders that we respond to needs. And sometimes there are things where clearly we shouldn't necessarily get involved. But our indifference is a concern. And in the situation in the Middle East, frankly, we're going to have to step on some toes on both sides if we're really going to get something done. And I would add one mistake I think we're making. I have been with Arafat, and I'm not sure I want to have this part recorded here, so you may delete this here when we get. I have been with Arafat on a few occasions. He is not the most stable kind of leader to work with. And I can see where he is difficult. But the United States and Israel cannot decide who the leader should be on the other side. You know, I've negotiated like the Chicago Northwestern Railroad strike. If I went to the head of the Chicago Northwestern Railroad and asked him to cooperate, and he said, "Well, I'll cooperate if you get a different union leader," you know, you couldn't get anywhere. We can state our principles, but the Palestinian people have to choose their leaders. The Israeli people have to choose their leaders, and this is true in any of these situations. We have to work with the leaders who are there. Sometimes it'll work out. We're not going to bat 1,000%.
The elections are coming soon.
I hear that.
Real soon. And there's a lot of candidates that I am very unfamiliar with, and I don't trust what I read in the media about any of them. As an insider to that whole system, who the hell do we vote for? But who might be embodying some of these principles that are so necessary for integrity and justice to be done?
I hate to tell you, I'm not going to endorse a candidate here tonight, but I think we have to be looking, in a sense, for a Harry Truman. We have to be looking for someone with courage to say some unpopular things. There aren't popular answers to all the problems that we face. And candidates like to give us popular answers. Don't go to a physician who tells you just what you want to hear. Don't go to a political candidate who tells you just what you want to hear. I think I have imposed on you long enough here.
We'll see you at the fireside.
Pardon? And at the fireside, and it says for the speaker, so I would like Chip and Sharon, wherever she disappeared to.
And they will be with you.
They will be okay. And so any tough questions, I'll refer to them. All right. Thank you.